Good morning. Welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Henry Frayne, is at the controls this morning. In this part of Focus, we'll be talking with a scholar who has done a lot of thinking about and writing about the relationship between people and their tools, the devices that they use and depend on every day, and about how design, good design, can either make these tools more user-friendly, function better, or, on the other hand, how bad design can make them much more difficult to use, sometimes impossible to use, and certainly very frustrating. Our guest is Donald Norman. He is the Breed Professor of Design at Northwestern University and writes about this in his book, The Design of Everyday Things. He's, in fact, authored a number of books on design, including that one and Emotional Design. This morning, we'll be talking about his new book, which is titled The Design of Future Things, and it is about the ever-increasing role of automation in our lives. It looks at the fact that now, and increasingly in the future, many of the devices that we use will have some kind of machine intelligence built in. They will be, quote-unquote, smart, although that doesn't necessarily mean that they will not be difficult or frustrating or problematic to use. Here's how he writes about it in the book. We are in the midst of a major change in how we relate to technology. Until recently, people have been in control. We turned the technology on and off, told it which operation to perform, and guided it through its operations. As technology became more powerful and complex, we became less able to understand how it worked, less able to predict its actions. Once computers and microprocessors entered the scene, we often found ourselves lost and confused, annoyed and angered. But still, we considered ourselves to be in control. No longer, now our machines are taking over. The book has recently been published by Basic Books. I'm sure you can find it in the bookstore. Don Norman is former vice president of Apple Computer and is a partner in the Nielsen Norman Group consulting firm, which consults with corporations on design. And he's joining us this morning by telephone. Questions and comments from people that are listening certainly are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That would be good any place that you can hear us. If it would be a long-distance call for you, use that number. That is 800-222-9455. Again, here in Champaign-Urbana, locally, the folks who are here where we are, use that number, 333-9455. But anybody else can use the toll-free. If you're listening over the air or over the internet, 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers to call. Professor Norman, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you.
We appreciate it. I know that, certainly you have done in your career a lot of different sorts of things, but that you are by your training a psychologist. How is it, I'm just curious about how it is that this particular area, the one that I think now people a lot of people associate you with, this good design, good bad design in terms of user friendliness. How was it that you that became a major focus for you?
Well, actually, I'm both an engineer and a psychologist. So I started off as an electrical engineer, worked on the early computers, did quite a bit of work as have 2 degrees in engineering. And then I switched to get my doctorate in psychology, and it's a wonderful combination because modern technology requires that, well, you understand both the technology and people.
Mm-hmm.
This all happened at Three Mile Island, a nuclear power accident, where I was called in with a bunch of other experts to try to understand why the operators were so stupid. How could they make those errors? And to our surprise and to my surprise, we discovered, you know, they were very clever, those operators, very smart, doing the appropriate things. But the design of the plant, if you wanted to design a plant to cause errors, you probably could not have done a better job. And so I began to realize that design was critically important. And, hey, I said, that's my engineering background and my psychology background together.
Mm-hmm. What, in brief, what makes the difference when we're talking about this very thing? We're talking about user friendliness, or at least when we're talking about the kind of outcomes that we desire. What really makes the difference between good design and bad design?
I don't use the word user friendliness. First of all, I hate the word user. It's not very friendly. I talk about people.
Mm-hmm.
And second, the user-friendly took on this connotation earlier that, oh, well, people are stupid, so we're going to hold them by the hand step by step by step. And that was so frustrating. See, the real issue about design is you have to understand the people, what they're trying to accomplish, and assume they're intelligent, but give them control. And what happens far too often, especially in the people who believe in user-friendliness, is I'm not going to give you control. You'll mess it up. I'm going to give you step by step by step, and I'm going to spank you when you do it wrong.
Mm.
You know, I spend the fall and spring in Evanston and the summer and winter in California. So I just got back late last night from after being in Evanston for 3 months, and I turned on my machines this morning, and they were insulted. You could see them saying, what? You haven't used me for 3 months? You can think you can just sit down now? No way. I mean, you have to take care of me. You have to update me. You have to caress me. You have to reboot me 18 times just as punishment because you neglected me for so long. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, just I guess I take your meaning about the term user friendliness. I guess what comes across to me in some of the work of yours that I've read is that in fact people aren't stupid. People are pretty smart. They actually do pretty good at figuring things out, provided though it has to do with how that thing is made, and does that thing in fact give you some kind of a clue as to how it is that it's it wants you to operate it.
Precisely. In the old days, the good old days of mechanical devices, which sometimes were pretty complicated, at least you could look at it, you could wiggle this and see what it did, and you could figure it out. Today, with these modern devices, there's nothing visible. It's all up to the arbitrary whims of some programmer or designers sitting, 10,000 miles away a couple of years ago, deciding, oh, I think it would be cute if we did it this way.
Mm-hmm.
So my whole argument is you have to give people a good conceptual model. They have to be able to say, oh, I see what it's doing now. And if everything has to be visible, or in some way you can experience it. You know, one of the things I really like is my tea kettle, because it just sits there. But as it starts to boil, it sort of rumbles a little bit, and you can kind of hear it until you know, oh, it's almost ready. And then as it starts to whistle, it doesn't whistle. It just goes, psh, psh, psh. And you can see, oh, it's almost there. And it's a natural sound. Because it's natural, it's extremely meaningful, and it's not abusive. It doesn't get in the way. It's not beep, 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 beep. So if we can only make more of our machines that do that. Now, the real issue we're facing today is that automobiles, your home entertainment system, even your refrigerator, has a mind of its own. And the automobile will say, no, you can't change into that lane. And it will say, you're too close to the car in front of me. It will automatically brake. It will automatically steer you back into your lane unless you apologize and turn the turn signal. The turn signal used to be how you told other cars you wanted to change lanes, and now it's going to be how you tell your own car, please, may I?
Mm-hmm.
And it's this clash of wills that's going to be a problem, and the machine wanting to do one thing and you wanting to do another.
Well, this, I suppose this goes back to what for some designers is an ingrained bias, that is that given the chance, people will do the wrong thing. And so perhaps what we want to do with these devices, particularly when it comes to safety, for example, is not give people the chance to do the wrong thing.
But remember, the designer is sitting in their own office miles away, and they don't know what you're really doing. They don't know what the real circumstances are. You see, the intelligence is not in the machine. It's in the head of the designer, who isn't present when the situation arises. So what the designer thinks may be the wrong thing may be precisely the correct thing at the moment.
And that, I think, probably gets to what sometimes frustrates people is they're using a device and they think to themselves, did the designer ever actually use this? Did they try this? And perhaps they did, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they used it in the way that you would naturally use it.
Yeah, actually, the designers do use their own things often, but they're not the right people to evaluate it. It's like an author. When you finish writing something, you are the wrong person to proofread it. Right? It makes good sense to you. You read it, and there's horrible mistakes, and your eye just passes over. There could be sentences that were unintelligible to everybody else, but you know what you wanted to say, and so sounds good to you.
Mm-hmm.
So for the same reason, if you're too close to the design, you can't evaluate it. The correct way is not to, you don't say, did the designer ever use it? You say, did the designer ever watch anybody else using it?
Are we going to, should we well expect that more and more the kinds of devices that do surround us are going to have some sort of built-in intelligence and will, I don't know if it's the right metaphor to say they're thinking for themselves, but they are indeed more and more going to be doing that?
And worse, they'll be talking with one another. And absolutely. I just walked into my kitchen and I can see there's my refrigerator. It has microprocessors. There's my coffee machine. It's very complex. It has microprocessors. There's my microwave oven. It has microprocessors. They all do, even toasters today. And they don't yet talk to each other, but they will.
Let's talk with someone who is listening here, a caller in Arcola. We'll bring them into the conversation here. This is line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I did want to, I had a niece who wrote the manuals for computer things, and she really was not very efficient at even using the computer herself, but she wrote about how to do this or that or program, and I often wondered, how can the writer write if they really can't do it? This is in the reading process that we get with all these wonderful machines.
Oh, actually, that's exactly the correct kind of writer you want.
Oh.
You don't want somebody who finds it really easy. You want somebody who struggles, because that's the kind of person who will have sympathy, who will write a manual that you can actually use.
Oh, okay.
The same with a teacher. You know, the teacher who finds science trivial and easy is not going to be a good teacher in many ways. You want a teacher who had to struggle a bit and then finally figured it out. That's the sort of person who can help the other people, help the students. But you know the problem with manual writers? They are frustrated because the companies don't use them right. I think the correct thing to do is first write the manual, make it really simple, then build the device to match the manual. Instead, people build these horribly complex things, and then they call in people, and they say, oh, quickly, we only have a week. Write a manual that makes it look like it was on purpose.
Okay. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Other callers are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Our guest is Donald Norman. He's professor of design at Northwestern University. He writes a lot about design. He's best known for his book, The Design of Everyday Things, which takes a look at how things are designed and how sometimes good design can make things easy to use and bad design make things difficult to use. His newest book is The Design of Future Things, which is about the increasing level of automation of machine intelligence that's built into the things that we use every day, the homes that we live in and the cars that we drive, the fact that often it's being done badly and that makes those things sometimes difficult to use or frustrating to use. He's also working on a book that tentatively is titled Why Things Don't Work, which is expected to be out late next year, and he's always on the lookout for things that don't work. So if you're interested in sending on suggestions to him, you can do that if you take a look at his website. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I'm interested in having you talk a little bit about contrasting two situations, and it's something that you write about in the book, and that is the relationship between riders and horses compared to the relationship between drivers and cars. The horse certainly has intelligence, and the way that the horse and the rider negotiate one another can actually work to the benefit of both. But it seems that as much as we might like to apply that kind of model to the relationship between a car and a driver, I guess my question is, are we ever going to get a car that's going to be in its way as smart as a horse is in its way, and to have the kind of two-way communication that people actually can have with horses with their cars?
Well, that's a complex question. Quick answer, and then I'll give you a long answer, is yes, we will have cars that can drive themselves. I won't say whether it's as smart as a horse or not, but we will have cars that will drive themselves and safely. And in the United States, we kill about 43,000 people a year in automobile accidents and injure another 6 million. So that will be a good thing. But the real problem is, how do we get there? And what happens in this intermediate stage, which will last quite a while, where the car can't quite manage everything. And so the person is sort of supposed to be partially in control when the car is partially in control. So I started trying to imagine what this was like, and I realized that, gee, when I ride a horse, that's exactly what's happening. The horse is taking control over the low-level activities and not stepping in a hole and, you know, jumping over fences and following the path. And the rider is giving high-level instructions about where the goal is, where we're going. And riders actually can vary the control. It's called tight rein versus loose rein. Tight rein is when you pull the reins more tightly and you sort of tell the horse, hey, I want to really guide you step by step. And loose rein is when you say, I'm going to go to sleep, or I want to talk to somebody, you take over. Hmm. Well, when we have a really good rider and a really good horse, it's as if it was one animal. It's a horse plus rider. That's one word, horse plus rider. And they work in smooth harmony. Now, when I ride a horse, I have no idea what I'm doing. I have no idea how to control it, and the horse knows this. And so it's a disaster, because I'm trying to do one thing, and the horse is trying to do another, and we're fighting all the way, and it's not pleasant for either of us. That's what's happening with the modern automobiles. You ask, will we ever have this kind of good communication that a good rider has with a good horse? I don't see it. In science, in linguistics, this is called the common ground problem. Do you share enough in common that you can really communicate? And I'm not going to share many of my life experiences with that of my car. And so we really talk different languages. We're interested in different things. My eyes work differently than the car's TV cameras. My sensors work differently than the car's. With a horse, actually, our eyes and our sensors work pretty much the same. Not with an automobile. So it's the communication, the interaction, that's where the disaster is going to be.
Mm-hmm. Of course, I'm sure a lot of people who have experience with horses would say that, in fact, there are periods where there is a struggle for control between the person and the animal, and that if the person doesn't win out, that there can be big problems.
Well, it's not so much if the person doesn't win out. I think it's if they don't decide which one is to be in control, there can be big problems.
Mm-hmm.
It's the fight that's the disaster. And yes, that simply makes my argument stronger, that modern automobiles are kind of like car plus driver, one word. And when those two are fighting with each other, that's when there are big problems.
Well, I guess that is part of the issue here that humans don't really want to give up control. They're uncomfortable with the idea of the car driving itself.
No, I don't think so. We do a lot of things. We have a lot of devices in our homes and in our lives that are automatic. Airplanes fly themselves quite well. So, and pilots are quite happy to relinquish control, as long as, and that's the trick, if I turn on my clothes dryer and I put the clothes in and I say go, and it's really pretty smart. It figures out what kind of clothes it is. It figures out what temperature to use. It figures out when it's dry, and it stops all by itself. I find that very relaxing. It's very nice. And the same with an airplane. If the airplane is actually working functionally well, it simplifies the lives of the pilots. The problem comes when it's only partially automatic, when you're not sure if you're in control or not, when it's the car is taking control, like with adaptive cruise control and slowing up when a car jumps in front of you, but it won't avoid a crash. So you have to sort of watch it and trust it, but not really trust it. And so I think it's the in-between stage that we really dislike, where we don't feel like we're in control, yet we are in control, and it's not clear who's doing what. And if the car is really so smart, then I can relax. But if I relax too much, oops, I'll miss the instant when the car no longer can cope. So I don't mind automation, and I think most people don't mind automation that works completely and perfectly and invisibly and properly. It's the in-between stages that are the problem.
Well, what are the kind of difficulties that involve meshing. I think that you sort of make this argument that if the way to make the most of this relationship, if you want to use a word like that, is by understanding the way the machines think and the way that humans think, and taking advantage of the best of both of those things. But if they're thinking in different ways, how do you go about meshing the two styles of thinking? Or is that possible?
Actually, the fact that we think in different ways can be a virtue. I use my calculator as an example of this. That it's a good thing my calculator doesn't do arithmetic the way I do it. I make mistakes. And so the mesh between me and the calculator is actually a good one, that I sort of invent what the problems are, but then I feed stuff to the calculator, and it figures out what the answer is, because it can do the mechanical stuff of multiplication, division, far better than I can. It can take square roots or nth roots. I can't do that. But I'm still the one in control. I set up what the problem is in the first place. And so in the automobile, it's pretty good at lots of things, and it can react far more quickly than I can. But I should still maintain the overall control. Let it do the low-level things. The stability. The stability controls in automobiles are very sophisticated, and they save lives. And they do not interfere with my feeling of control.
Talk about communication, again, to the extent that it's possible to talk about the idea of a person communicating with a machine. How can communication between the person and the machine be improved? And can we ever expect that we would be able to communicate with a machine the way we can communicate with another person?
I do not think we will be able to communicate with a machine like we do with a person, at least not for quite a long time. My friends who work in the field of artificial intelligence and what's called computational linguistics, they actually believe this will be possible. But, you know, when a scientist thinks something is really hard and you ask them how long it will take, they always say 10 years. So they say this is 10 years away. What that means is 10 years from now, you ask them how long it will be, they'll say 10 years. It's always 10 years away. It's hard because of this problem called common ground. We share so much knowledge, you and I as people, that we can talk in this abbreviated thing we call language, whereas machines don't share anything in common. So I believe that's where the problem is, that today we don't have communication with our machines. We tell the machines things to do, turn it on, flip a switch. It tells us what to do, you know, brake, slow up. And those are monologues. It's a monologue from me to the machine, a monologue from the machine to me, and two monologues are not a dialogue.
We're just about at our midpoint here in this part of Focus 580. Again, our guest is Donald Norman. He's the Breed Professor of Design at Northwestern University. He's a former vice president of Apple Computer, partner in the Nielsen Norman Group consulting firm, which consults with corporations on design. He's the author of a number of books on design, including Emotional Design and the best-selling Design of Everyday Things. His most recent book is The Design of Future Things. It's published by Basic Books, and it takes a look at the ever-increasing role of automation in devices that we use every day, things like automobiles, for example, or the houses that we live in, or the appliances that are in those homes. Why is it that, and why it is, the book looks at why it is that in some cases, this increasing automation, the machine intelligence that's put into these devices is being done badly, and also makes suggestions for doing it right. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Maybe, it would help people thinking about this to have some concrete examples. Maybe you could give an example again with this particular thing in mind, that is increasingly intelligent, quote unquote, machines, smart machines, a good example of good design and bad design, and what the difference is.
One of the more frustrating devices in our homes is the television set. I mean, used to be television sets were pretty simple. You turned to the station, and you adjusted the volume, and that was it. But today, well, we have a television set, and we have a VCR, and we have a DVD player, and we have an audio system, and we have satellites or cable or over-the-air, and you have a choice of do you want 1080i or 1080p or 720p or 480i, all these weird numbers and letter combinations, and it becomes a mess. You ever look behind your TV set? It's a mess of wires, right?
Yes, yes.
And, you know, I want to buy a new HD high-definition DVD player if the company, if the industry ever figure out which standard they want to have. But, wow, the thing that really scares me about it is not the price. It's hooking up all those wires. I don't feel I have any control. And I'm an engineer. In fact, I helped establish the standards. I was part of the committee the FCC talked to when the computer companies and the television companies were trying to agree on a standard. But I get completely confused with all those wires and connections and what is it I'm trying to watch and how does it work? So that's bad design. And it's, you know, it's not bad design. It's lack of design. The problem is every little piece of equipment is made by a different part of the company or by different companies. They don't talk to each other. In fact, they don't want to talk to each other. They don't like each other. And so they make it harder and harder and harder. Now, I have a what's called a digital video recorder in my system made by TiVo. That's good design. The TiVo people really understood what I'm trying to do. And they really revolutionized the way we watch TV. When you used to program the VCR, you had to say, oh, let me see, I want to watch Channel 7 at 6:30 at night. Well, that's not what you want to do. You want to watch a particular show. You might want to watch the news, or you might want to watch a favorite comedy show. And what TiVo let you do for the first time was just go through the list of shows and say, that one, save it for me. Mm-hmm. So what it means is I could just tell it what I'm interested in, and next time I want to watch television, I say, okay, what have you got for me? And it lists the shows I've told her to record. And while it's at it, it sort of watched over me, so here's the intelligence, and decided, oh, this person watches this show and this show and this show. Well, here's another one that's just like it. So I'll tell you what, I had nothing else to do, so I recorded it for you anyway. I had some spare room, so don't worry about it. But if you're interested, here it is. And if I'm interested, I play it, and TiVo says to himself, he liked my choice. I guess I'll get more of things like that. But the neat thing is, it's voluntary. It doesn't get in my way. That's the kind of automation that I like.
Hmm. It seems like the difference between the two things is that as the devices get more complicated, they do more things, they have more parameters that you can adjust. The problem is that maybe the engineers think people are going to actually want to do that. Like if you were an engineer, they're going to want to get in there and fiddle around with things. And maybe, in fact, there are people who are, but probably most people are just going to want it to do the thing that it wants, that they want it to do. And they would like to, as in the case of the TiVo, they would simply like to be able to say to it, do this. And
well,
the machine will say, yeah, okay, I'll go and do that. And that's most machines somehow, they're not smart enough to do that.
Well, but here's a different issue then. I was talking to some friends at Siemens, and they told me about their new washing machine, their very super advanced washing machine, that can figure out exactly what kind of clothes you have and how dirty it is. So it knows what temperature to use, what cycles to use, when to stop, when to start. So I said, that's wonderful. It means I could have a washing machine with just one button that says start. You load it with the clothes and maybe dump in some soap and say start, and it can figure out all the rest. But I looked at a picture of the machine, and it had more knobs and more controls than even the simpler machines. And I said, wait a minute, why are you doing that? I mean, this is supposed to be easier. And they said, oh, don't you want to have control? And I said, no, I just want to say start and do it. They also pointed out, you know, this automatic machine is more expensive. So if you went to the store to buy a washing machine, and there was an inexpensive one that had all sorts of wonderful controls over temperature and time and type of clothes, and another machine that was much more expensive but just had an on-off button, mm-hmm. you would feel cheated. You'd say, why is that more expensive? It doesn't do as much.
Mm.
So here it is. The better machine, in my opinion, is getting to be overcomplicated because they seem to think that marketing requires it.
And does it really cost more to build the machine that is smart enough to know how to do everything and all you have to do is push the button that says start? Is that really a more complicated machine to build and therefore reasonable that it should be more expensive?
I think it is at first. And don't forget, it's not just whether it's more complicated or difficult to build, but it's also, it costs quite a bit of money in the research laboratories to develop the technology. And so you're, that's why a lot of items, I mean, that's why a book costs so much. It's not because the printing and the paper costs much, but you have to pay for all the copy editors and all the people who worked on the book to make it possible. So you have to do pay back some of those research costs.
Let's talk with another caller here. We have someone in Coles County. This is on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Hello. Good morning, Don.
Good morning.
I'm a psychologist, and I worked in human factors back in the early 50s. At that time, it was very difficult to get engineers to pay any attention to what we told them in terms of man-machine interactions.
Mm-hmm.
Have things improved any in the last 50-some years?
Well, yes and no. I think that more and more companies do pay attention. I notice this is getting to, this is certainly true in the aviation business and certainly true in the computer business. TiVo is a good example where they really do hire people who understand what's called human-computer interaction, which is a subset of human factors. But on the other hand, wow, as new companies come in, it's amazing how badly they fare. And the automobile companies are particularly bad at it. They all have human factors groups, and when I visit them, all the human factors groups complain that nobody listens to them. So, yeah, welcome to the modern world. It's just the same as the old world.
Well, I've been a part-time farmer in the past 30 years, and I spend a good deal of my time cursing out design engineers. I figured I could blow out half my brains and still come up with 10 better ways of doing something.
Actually, what's amusing is one of the earliest references I found to complexity was in the 1600s. Somebody wrote a little pamphlet about the modern plow. This is 1600s, that the plow had so many adjustments and so many things to control that it was a wonder anybody could figure out how to use it.
Well, I have a friend who worked with engineers, and he defined an engineer as a person with a mind so narrow he could look through a keyhole with both eyes at the same time.
No comment.
Well, it was good to hear you.
Well, thank you for the call. Others are welcome. Engineers want to call in and defend themselves. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455.
I must tell you, I'm a professor in the School of Engineering at Northwestern.
And I'm sure that you know many fine engineers, and there are many fine engineers here and other. We don't want to run down engineers, obviously. What though? It seems though that there are two different kinds of mindsets when you come to approach a device, one that just seems to make it more complicated than most people would want it to be or that it needs to be, and the other, you know, the difference between the control panel that has 100 buttons and the control panel that has one. I mean, what really makes the difference between the two different kind of approaches? Or, why is it that one would tend to go one way and one would tend to go the other?
I think it's our own fault. People keep complaining to me. They say, wouldn't it be nice if we could just get a cell phone that just made phone calls instead of these horribly complicated things? And I always say, yes, wouldn't that be nice? You'd have a cell phone, it would have a couple, you know, the number buttons on the front and maybe talk and end. And you'd love that, wouldn't you? And they say, yes, yes, why can't anybody make that? And I'd say, well, now, if you missed some phone calls, wouldn't you like to know who called you so you could call them back? Well, of course. What about the people you call frequently? Wouldn't you like to save their addresses, their phone numbers, so you wouldn't have to redial it or remember it each time? You could just say, call John, call my home, call whatever. Oh, of course. Well, each one of those requires, a screen, a menu, an extra button.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can add to the list, I can go on forever. Wouldn't you like to be, light up at night? Wouldn't you like, if you could do this, could do that? And before long, you have the modern cell phone. And every one of those extra features that confounds us and frustrates us makes our life more... Every one of those features was something we asked for. Someone recently did a marketing study, in which they tried to get people to, first of all, complain about what really bothered them, and second of all, to ask what extra features they would like. And basically, all the people said, all those extra features makes our life miserable. But in fact, I'd actually like a few more things on my cell phone. And they all realized that there was a conflict, that the very things they wanted was the very things they were complaining about in complexity. But that's human nature.
Well, I guess multifunctionality can be very tempting. And it's nice to, when you start thinking about adding on features, the idea of a small handheld device that can be a phone, a word processor, send messages, download video. While you're at it, maybe you might like to keep your favorite music on there and you'd be able to surf the web. Well, of course, there are devices that will do that, and maybe people do want to do all that, but then you end up with this tiny thing that's got 1,000 buttons on it, and you start to wonder, is there some sort of trade-off between multifunctionality and a device that's actually reasonable to use? Maybe the thing is we need to have a range of devices, so if someone wants to have a Palm Pilot or a BlackBerry and it will do all those things, fine. But then we still, for the person who just says, I just want to make phone calls, maybe we also need to have the choice for them. We can say, okay, here's a phone, and all it will do is make phone calls, and if that's all you want, fine. And maybe the problem is that we need to have a wider range of choice of the kind of devices that people can use.
That's exactly what I would like to see. Unfortunately, it's difficult today because the handset manufacturers, the people who make the cell phones, have remarkably little control over what they make. The control is dictated to them by the service providers, the wireless people, the Verizons, T-Mobiles of the world, who really tell you what can be in the phone and what can't be. Now, there's hope for a change. Apple broke through. When they developed their iPhone, they said, we're going to develop the phone, and you take it the way we build it, or we're not giving it to you. And the first company they approached said, no, that's not how we do business. And so Apple went to a second company, which today is AT&T. But AT&T had essentially no control over what was in the iPhone. And what that did was make all the other telephone manufacturers really happy. They said, hey, maybe we could finally take control over what's happening. Now, there's another story about the iPhone, which is a good illustration of what you're talking about. I don't use one. People ask me, well, how come? I mean, you love Apple products, and it's really well designed. Why don't you use it? And the answer is, because it doesn't suit my needs. But that's not a bad thing. It means that Apple did absolutely the correct thing. They said, we're not going to make a telephone for Don Norman. We're not going to make a telephone for a busy consultant and professor who travels around the world and needs to have... I have 3,000 addresses and people in my address book, and I have a detailed schedule, sort of 15 minutes by 15 minutes. We're not going to make a phone for that kind of person. We're going to make an entertainment phone that's really easy to see pictures, watch videos, listen to music. Oh, yeah, it's also a phone, but it's really about enjoying life. And if you want to be a business person, go buy a business phone. That's the correct way to design. Decide who you want to approach, what you want to emphasize, and don't bother about the rest. So what it should be is in my everyday life, I'll use an iPhone, and in my business life, I'll use a business phone. The problem is it's not so easy to do today because I'd like to have just one phone number. So what I'd love to be able to do is say, this is my phone today, so let it be my phone number, and then switch to the Apple phone, say, and say, oops, I'm carrying this out, so let this one ring when somebody dials that same phone number. That's hard. But it's the same principle you're talking about. Give us a lot of choice. Like when I buy kitchen utensils, I go to the kitchen supply store and there's 10,000 things to choose among. I can choose just the kind of spatula I like, just the kind of frying pan I like. And in my home, I have a wide variety because different things I cook require different kinds of utensils. Let's do the same with all of our appliances and with our telephones.
Our guest is Donald Norman. He's professor of design at Northwestern and has written a lot about good and bad design and how that can either make devices easy to use and make our life better or make them difficult to use and make our life somehow more difficult and more frustrating. You might look at his book, The Design of Everyday Things, to read about that. And then his new book is The Design of Future Things. It's published by Basic Books, and it is about the ever-increasing role of automation in so many of the devices that we use every day. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana if you'd like to join the conversation. We also have toll-free line good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. We have several callers here, all in a line and in Urbana to talk with. So let's do that, starting with line number one. Hello.
Hi. One of my requirements is that the item be sturdy. I don't want to have to go out and figure out what to buy next in 2 years. My current cell phone, I've replaced the batteries multiple times. I think it must be 6, 8 years old, even maybe even older. And it does just fine. It doesn't have a speakerphone. It might be nice to have a speakerphone. It doesn't have a camera. Oh, well, I can do without a camera. But I haven't gone out and spent the money to have either an expensive cell phone plan or to buy new cell phones. It also means that I'm freed up my money to do something else with. It seems that we're creating a tremendous amount of waste by having things that break down and then we just toss out. And it's going to end up killing us because of all the crummy things that are in these devices. And if it doesn't kill us, it's going to kill people in the third world. The other thing is compulsory gift giving, I think, is one of the things that drives this this ever need to have more and more and more complicated things. And so for, although I was raised in the Christian tradition, we've slowed down and almost stopped in our gift giving. And like when my son said, "We don't know what to get you," I said, "Don't." I have anything that I want to buy, I can do a better job of picking it out than you can, and I can afford it. I'll buy what I want if I need it, so just forget about it. And give instead to some organization that improves life someplace else. But it seems as though we just feel like we have to go around giving gifts to people, and we end up buying more and more stuff as a way of showing that we care about somebody, and I think we need to. I think it would be a good idea if we rethought some of those gift things so that we weren't buying electronics and gadgets that just give gifts. Anyway, those are my thoughts. I'm down off my soapbox.
Well, I appreciate the comments, and I don't know if Professor Norman, you would want to reflect on that. I guess particularly I'm interested in the first part, and that has to do with the durability of devices and whether or not we think, and who the people who design and produce them think, it's important that things last.
Well, that's, of course, a problem in our capitalist society. So actually, I commend you that you're still using your phone and you're happy with it, so good. Keep using it. Don't be forced by our consumer society to have to buy a new one. Wasn't it Ralph Waldo Emerson who wrote the wonderful poem about the automobile, that the whole point was that it should collapse, but it should collapse all at the same time, because if only half the pieces broke, well, it meant that the other pieces were built too strongly. That's a really bad way to design things, but the poem shows it's been with us for hundreds of years.
Do you think that the increasing drive for multifunctionality in devices, does that somehow make them more perishable?
In principle, no. In practice, yes, because as things get more complex, their interactions are beyond anybody's comprehension, and so they tend to get in each other's way and break. You know, in the modern computer and the modern cell phone, no single individual understands how it works. The amount of what we call lines of computer code, each line is an instruction. Those, they can be millions or even tens of millions of lines of instruction. So there's no individual who can read them all and comprehend it all. So no wonder it doesn't always work right and it gets in each other's way.
Let's talk with someone else. This is Urbana, line number two. Hello.
Hello there.
Yes.
I'm having a cell phone moment, so I'll just have to spit them out and then move on.
Okay.
First, with my cell phone, I'm using an old one now that I can't upgrade because I would have to take, I believe, GPS and digital, and I don't really want to do that. Number two, TiVo. The ulterior motives there of TiVo is that I have to provide them all that valuable information that I'm giving them and take a razor blade subscription after they've sold me the razor. And my alternative, TVGOS, for example, isn't used very much. And there was a third example, HDTV. The problem there isn't just the complexity of the design, isn't it? But because they can't settle on something that's going to be copy-proof enough. They have licensing problems in mind that makes my life complicated. So I think marketing and the needs of the manufacturers sometimes overwhelm not only the engineers and the consumers. So I'll ask the professor what he thinks about those three.
Right. Well, yes, your observations are correct. Actually, not correct for HDTV. The so-called digital rights management issue is for the DVD players, not for the over-the-air transmission of the signals. With TiVo, TiVo is a problem. It has revolutionized the way we watch TV, but the company may very well disappear and go bankrupt. It has never made a profit. So what are they to do? And so they've been struggling to figure out what to do, and so, oops, they're selling the private information about what shows you watch, what commercials you skip over, what commercials you actually do watch, what your preferences are, and et cetera. They're trying hard to make it anonymous, but nonetheless, it's your information. And the problem is, otherwise they won't survive. So that's a real ethical dilemma that many companies are getting into. And the reason they sell you a subscription is, once again, if they sell you the device for a couple $100 and you're happy for the rest of your life, oops, how are they going to keep in business? So many companies love to have a subscription model that whatever it is they sell you, you still have to pay something month after month after month. In fact, even after you die, your successors won't know how to turn it off. So even after you die, you'll pay month after month after month.
This whole, again, going back to this issue of multifunctionality and people perhaps having to pay for services that they really don't want, does that say something about the fact that as devices get more complicated, that somehow there's a self-perpetuating thing here that says we cannot make money providing you a simple service anymore? That for example, is somehow that a company would say, in just building a phone that makes calls and charging you for just making calls, somehow we can't make money doing that anymore, and we've got to charge you try to get you to take additional services, even if you're not really don't want those things or not going to use them.
I believe that reasoning is incorrect, but I also agree that's exactly the reasoning that the telephone companies are using, and I think it just shows a lack of imagination.
Let's talk again with another Urbana caller. This is line 3. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. I wanted to bring up the question of efficiency. Is it the case that the way engineers are taught and function, striving for efficiency, gets in the way of actual competent use?
Yes. But more and more in our engineering courses, we're trying to change that. So it is absolutely true, if you try to optimize the technical requirements, you may make it really miserable for the person trying to use the device. It's the same argument of productivity in the workplace, which can make it pretty miserable on the people who have to actually work there. But there's what we call a human-centered approach to design that is being taught to engineers and actually being taught to business people who design the workplace, to realize that, you know, it's the people that you really should design for, because, if a machine is less efficient than it might otherwise be, so what? But if a person is really frustrated, it's a major problem. So in the workplace, in the use of our engineering equipment, more and more there's a focus on human-centered design.
I just wanted to bring up the example of the earliest car digital displays. They were as part of a radio. And I remember you could push a button that said clock, and you would see what time it was. But there was no button for changing that time when you shifted for whatever reason. Instead, you had to hold two or three buttons on the radio control. And I'm sure from an efficiency standpoint, that was great. You had fewer buttons doing many more things. But I noticed very quickly that cars soon had a little M and H button, and people actually wanted to change the minutes and the hours intuitively rather than engineeredly.
But see, I would take that as a positive story. What you're saying is there was some bad design and was noticed and corrected by the people who made the automobile clocks and radios.
What I'm afraid is that if you ask an engineer for a musical instrument, you might wind up with a cello, because there are fewer parts. And once you've got a string tensioned, it's up to you to put your finger on the exact place that gives you the exact note. But what the user wanted was a piano, because every time you pushed a particular key, you got a particular note. without having to know where to carefully put your fingers after years and years of training. So the engineer might make you a cello, and you'd complain, and he'd eventually come back with a piano. But is that process of getting the wrong thing first and then correcting it just probable because engineers take efficiency to an extreme? It's one of their real virtues.
Well, I think the spirit of what you are saying is correct, but I think that most musicians would kind of argue with you to argue that a piano is better than a cello. They're different. They produce different kinds of sounds and different kinds of music, and each one has its place.
Let's real quick get one more caller, Vermilion County, line 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'd like to speak for standardization. One of the issues is that almost any device you can learn how to use, but if you go from one home to an office to another place and try to use a microwave oven, it is the most frustrating thing because they are not all operated the same way. And like if you go rent a car, in general, they seem to have gotten the basics of transmission forward and backwards fairly well standardized. And I think that in terms of efficiency and safety and lots of other things, if the manufacturers or whoever would figure out what would be user-friendly in general, people would benefit from standardization.
There's an old saying in the standards business is, aren't standards wonderful? That's why there are so many to choose them. The problem in standards, the arguments you make are absolutely correct, but it's the rule of thumb is that the company that leads the market doesn't want standards. They want to say, look, you want to use something that's easy and it's always the same, buy our company's products. It's the companies that are competing and that are the second or third or 20th in the marketplace. They're the ones that want standards because they wanted to make it easy to switch from the market leader to them. And the market leader wants it to be difficult to switch from them to another player. And so there's a lot of fighting in the standards business. So even the automobile, it took decades to agree upon the placement of the brake and accelerator and clutch pedals and the standard kind of shifting mechanisms. And they, despite decades of meetings of standards committees all around the world, they still can't figure out where the horn should be, where the various things, the stalks that stick out of the steering wheel, how they should work. There are two standards of where reverse should be in a manual shift, in the upper left or in the bottom right. Agreeing upon standards, everybody thinks it's a good idea, except for the market leader. Trying to reach agreement is really hard.
We're going to have to leave it at that. Our guest, Donald Norman, is professor of design at Northwestern. His new book is The Design of Future Things, published by BASIC. Professor Norman, thanks very much.
You're quite welcome. I enjoyed it.